Welcome back, everybody, to the Classic Rock Podcast. And coming up in this edition, we have a fine array of guests and music. Now, Leonard Cohen once said that success is survival. And the man behind Hawkwind's success has survived and continues to thrive into his eighth decade. I'm talking, of course, about Dave Rock, and he joins us to talk about the new Hawkwind album, Stories of Space and Time, as well as a selection of tales from throughout this rather extraordinary career, including where he once actually sat down and taught Eric Clapton a thing or two about blues chords. This was a very young Eric Clapton, and very young Dave Brock, by the way, because it was pre-Cream. Now, over the course of the last year in particular, we've showcased some of the best female vocal talent out there. Think back over the last 12 months, we've spoken to Lila Baum of The Damn Truth, Caitlin Crisco from The Broadcast. Both of those, by the way, have new albums to come and tours this year. And today we continue with that trend because we talk with one of those vocalists who, when you initially hear them for the very first time, you literally stop what you're doing and think, who is this? And then you tend to go off, don't you, onto one of these streaming providers and look up everything that they've done. With that in mind, we're going to introduce you to Megan Parnell from Bywater Call, who has possibly one of the greatest vocal ranges out there. Very few can get close to what she can produce. And she joins us to talk about her origins, how she got involved in music, the upcoming Bywater Call album, and their tour. And if you've not heard them before, then you really need to do yourself a favour. And we will hear a track or two from them before the end of this programme. Now, let's start by taking a look at some of the things that have happened over the last couple of weeks since we were last with you. And how about this is a good place to start. This has been described as a seismic collaboration. It involves Billy Morrison, the Billy Morrison who worked with The Cult and who's been with Billy Idol for the last, 10, 12 years. He has collaborated with Ozzy Osbourne and Steve Stevens. The Morrison Project is coming very soon. And this is the track that has just been released. It is called Crack Cocaine. We'll be right back. track. That is, Billy is going to be on the show in April. So keep an eye out for that. And talking about the song, he said this music was a direct result of sitting in a room with Steve, that's Steve Stevens, both with detuned guitars, and writing what we felt was an ultimate Aussie riff. And he went on to say that from there we brought Ozzy over and 90% of the lyrics came from him. And he suddenly stood up and sang, like crack cocaine. And we just looked at each other and thought, well, there's your title. And as for the subject matter, the song is 100% about how certain relationships can feel like an addiction. It is nothing whatsoever to do with the drug. It is a comparison. It's exactly like a drug addiction. So there you go. Now, if you're a fan of the 80s era Black Sabbath, the version with Tony Martin, which ran from the late 80s into the 1990s, then there's some great news, because a box set, a deluxe edition of remastered versions of those albums, it's called Anno Domini, it's coming out very soon. It's in May. So what you will get in this box set is Headless Cross, Tear Cross Purposes. These are all remastered. And there is a full remixed version of the album Forbidden. Now, personally, the first two, Headless Cross and Tear, were criminally overlooked at the time. And both of them were significantly better than the Return of Dio for Dehumanizer. I remember seeing that tour. I still got the T-shirt. Also saw them with Ray Gillen, another excellent frontman who is sadly no longer with us. Steve Perry has been getting emotional, so it says. This has all come about after Don't Stop Believing was officially recognized by the Recording Industry of America as the biggest song of all time. 18 times platinum. In other words, 18 million sales over the years. Wow. Absolutely incredible, isn't it? And Journey, of course, out over the course of the summer with Def Leppard. They are going to be visiting Europe at the end of the year, the 50th anniversary. There's a whole load of stuff coming out. There's a load of books being released, actually, by Journey. And we're going to be talking to Nick DeRiso, who has actually put one of them out. I'm just waiting to get a copy of it to read. A couple of other things before we move on. If you are in the vicinity of the Rainbow Bar and Grill on April the 19th, head over. They are going to enshrine Lemmy's ashes there. They're also unveiling a new Motorhead whiskey as well, so should be a good night. And finally, the Dead Daisies are back in the studio in Nashville and Muscle Shoals, working alongside Marty Friedrichsen, and there is a new member of the team. Well, nearly new. He's returning to the drum stool. Tommy Clufitos is back. There's a tour of the US, which kicks off on June 6th. New album is coming out as well. And check out the recent features we did with David Lowy and Doug Aldridge, Glenn Hughes, and most recently, John Karabi. You can find them all on the website or on the YouTube page, the Classic Rock Show X. And so now, part one of the interview that we recorded with Dave Brock, who was down on the farm this week recording and rehearsing, also sitting in Magnus and Chris. So coming up, we're going to be looking ahead to stories of time and space, and we're going to look back at some moments in time from the last 6 decades. And to take us there, here is the first release from the album. It is called The Starship, One Love, One Life.
well. Don't waste it away. Just feel the earth, touch the sky and have a good day. Enter the Stardome, get your ticket on the right. Take a seat, just relax.
It'll appeal.
Here we are then, Dave, a year on. And yes, we are now at, I've counted them, it is album number 66 in 54 years, which is a staggering achievement. I mean, this is over an album every single year of your entire career. Were you aware that you've been as productive as this?
Yeah, God, really, someone else told me. I mean, it's, you know, with compilations, and funny enough, as you mentioned this, I suddenly found out that Warner Brothers, in connection with Sony, around the world, had issued this album years ago, 85 times, unbeknown to me, and every other member of the band that were on it. And with our minor percentage that we get from these records, it does piss one off somewhat, you know.
But listen, the interest and the coverage, rather than shrinking, has expanded over the last few years. This time last year, when we were talking about the future album, the reviews were amazing. You know, late career highlights. Impressive is the ambition and range of styles that have been explored. And I remember when we spoke about that album, you said, oh, we've already done the next one, which presumably was this one. Right. So,
and in fact, funny enough, you should mention that.
Yeah, Dave's actually already done the next one as well now.
Angus has done one as well too, I might add.
Oh, yeah.
So you have actually got another album ready to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got an idea. We've got lots of tracks all done. I mean, we just have to polish them up a bit.
So
I think there's about 40 minutes, I think, Dave's done so far.
Well, it's just phenomenal, actually, when you sit back and take it all in. Your work rate is just off the scale prolific. So what was the objective then when you set to work on Stories of Time and Space? I mean, if you can remember last year. So what were you setting out to achieve that was different from what came on the previous album?
Well, we were trying to make it sound a bit idea-wise differently, weren't we?
Well, I think the inspiration came because Rob Godwin did the book about the history of Hawkwind and space rock, and that was the kind of inspiration, wasn't it, to find it, wasn't it? And we got back into the ideas about space rock and all the things that led to space rock, you know, like the classical music at the time and the technology, you know, in the late 60s. And,
you know, are you still delving into science fiction literature, i.e. things that are produced now, or are you actually drawing on the hundreds of books and articles that you've actually consumed over the years?
No, at the moment I'm reading, what am I reading? Where is it? I'm reading The Last Rainforests of Britain, which is nothing to do with science fiction whatsoever. What about you, Maggie?
I mean, you've made these stories up yourself, really, haven't you? For there's a man who's got to get rid of all the human waste into the, chuck them into the suns and
burn it all up. And the album that we're doing now is about the uselessness of human beings, basically.
Well, that's
another subject. So we're on the world stories of space and time. Yeah.
Yes, because I want to say that the whole landscape, when you think about it, has changed regarding the science fiction, sci-fi, space rock, I suppose, if you want to add that onto it. Yeah, back when you began, science fiction of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people would sort of look at you and think, oh, God, nerd or mad. If you started talking about anything to do with the universe and space and otherworldly beings. But today, as we are now, it's a completely different landscape because people want to believe. People aren't afraid of these things. So when you think back then, did you ever think that we would get to where we are now?
Yeah, a lot quicker, though. It's very slow, that's the trouble, because I mean, communicators, which are on mobile phones now, of just getting little apps that you can go to a foreign country and speak into your phone, and immediately it translates, and the person you're talking to would translate. Things like that, we were, you know, should have happened at least about 50 years ago.
Well, when you think about this, I mean, you touch on the subject of what happens. Mars, I mean, you writing songs about, you know, beings on Mars and whatever, people would dismiss you as some sort of grown-up kid, you know. But now we are sitting there looking at daily images, yeah, and videos sent back from the Mars rover with 4K quality, yeah, video.
And of course, you know, life was there. I mean, you know, if you put it into perspective of the universe, you know, when Mars died out and then Earth was probably full up with volcanoes and things happening. And what happened to the life that was on Mars? Did they leave? When you look at all the cities like 5,000 years ago that are all destroyed, and who knows what's happened.
I mean, the James Webb Telescope, I mean, publishing, yeah, these incredible deep, yeah, space pictures and images, and now they're telling us that the Big Bang, you know, the beginning, yeah, of everything, it didn't actually happen. So that's, you know, everything that people have believed for what the scientists have believed for decades and decades, that none of that ever happened now. All about time and movement and expansion and so on. It opens up a whole new world of potential storylines, yeah, for albums for you and songs.
More knowledge. It's knowledge, isn't it, really? To gain more and more knowledge. But it's a very slow process. That's the unfortunate thing. Will we make it? As well, because all the problems that are going on around the world as we speak, you know, like COVID, look at, yeah, the problems, yeah, that's caused long term. Look, I mean, we've got wars going on constantly, and, you know, the threat of wars. Will we actually progress forward, Magnus?
Well, it does say now we're all planning to go and live on Mars rather than keep this planet okay.
So we're talking about the album and the opening track of the album, Our Lives Can't Last Forever. So it's almost like we're talking about the end of days before we've actually even got into track two. But
it's a very doomy beginning to the album, isn't it? But and then it kind of cheers up as we go along.
Yeah, I was the lyrics were interesting, actually. The mirror sees the lines on the face. It's no disgrace, our lives can't last forever. Is this actually just a reminder that obsession with youth or trying to be young, looking young, is pointless and you should just basically embrace age?
Well, I can't speak for Dave, but I think he's just basically, there's a sort of assumption that we can, we as in a band, can go on forever and ever and ever, and that Dave's invincible. But and I think he's just pointing out that that all things come to an end eventually. Yeah.
That's the way life is. Everybody thinks they can last forever, and they can't.
In terms of the music, it sort of lulls you into thinking that the album's going to have more of an ambient vibe, but it's very much far from it, because when we move on to Starship, One Love, One Life, I mean, this is got the real feel of classic Hawkwind space rock.
Well, I hope so. Well, I mean, it's it's a story about going off on a spaceship to another world, isn't it, really? Heaven, the actual planet Heaven, where everything,
yeah,
is just like Utopia, where everything is, all the streets are paved with gold.
Well, the simple message in that, wasn't it? Use your life well, don't waste it away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all these songs have got good psychology in them, aren't they, really? I suppose that's the thing. They're all messages. Isn't that true, Magnus? They are messages, philosophical messages.
I think it's interesting that you said it was space rock. I thought it had quite a sort of jazzy kind of
disco,
kind of almost sort of Latin feel to it. You know.
Galaxy 117, where's that? because it's a place just like heaven.
Oh yeah, well, where is it? Well,
is that the farm?
If only.
But you succeeded in doing that, in producing a song which, and this is from a listener perspective, 7 minutes 40. So when you look at the fact there's a song running for 7 minutes 40, you'd be thinking, yeah, by the time it gets to the end, I'll be glad it got to the end. But when you get to the end of that, you actually feel like you wish there was some more of it.
Well, there was actually. That it was cut down a bit.
It lasted 10 minutes.
It lasted 10 minutes in actual fact. And
we are on the same wavelength.
There was a boy in the band. There was a boy in the band. I can't name who it was. Said, I think it's a bit too long. Actually, I think we'll have to cut it down.
Do you know what? That is a note that I made on the when I was listening to it, and I thought I said I've just literally said, how do you make a song that's 7 minutes 40 feel like it's ending too soon? So there you go. That can be for the deluxe edition, Dave.
Well, there are. There's also, what's it? One of the other songs quite long, isn't it?
Is it The Tracker? It's quite long.
Traveller. The Traveller, Space and Time. Yeah, that's quite minutes. Long. That's been cut down. That's about 12 minutes long, that was.
Yeah. It's amazing when you use two chords.
Well, I have said this before. You can play one chord for half an hour and never get boring. So,
what are we going to do while we're here? So where were you going with this? I noticed the androids are playing up again infringement of their
That's
rights.
Right, yeah,
so is this, are the androids basically the your observations of the general public these days just kicking off?
Well, obviously, robots that work on the machine and they... as they become more humanized, they form a union. That's what they form a union, all the androids do, and then they go on strike because they want to be maintained correctly, and the engineers have made them a lazy. And there is logic behind these words, you know.
The tracker, again, that's an interesting topic, hearing sounds from the galaxy we found. And you mentioned in here, which was quite interesting, so many objects floating in the universe. And that's quite right, actually, because you touched on a point that made a news story not that long ago, I think in the last week, where they've been talking about there being over a million pieces of space junk floating around the galaxy.
Well, I mean, the tracker is actually looking for life, really. Receiving communications from various planets and trying to make sense, hoping that you know, there is life on a planet millions and millions of light years away, on which he does eventually finds there is life, and then it's a worrying situation. What's going to happen when they make contact with him and arrive here and take over Earth and eat all the humans because they live on the humans.
I mean, the thing is, though, you do think, don't you, the more we travel through our lives and time, whatever, that it is just a matter of time. And you hope that you're here and around and it's going to be in our generation where there is something found.
Well, one hopes it might actually change the way we all are.
Then. Yeah, yeah. Till I found you then, searching for the hidden door that unlocks all of our problems.
Yeah, maybe into hell or beyond, isn't it?
Yeah, there's the hell reference at the end, isn't there? But, I mean, the beginning of that song, which we actually was on the last album, wasn't it? But yeah. I was just watching this. It was just from a romantic film with James Mason and Ava Gardner, and she goes. They spend eternity together on this ghost ship, you know. And at one point she says, "Oh, it's as if we're under a spell outside of time," you know.
Outside of time.
Yeah. And I just thought, God, that sounds like a Hawkwind lyric.
Was there an intention when you were putting this album together? I mean, I know we have instrumentals here, Underwater City. the night sky, regenerate the Black Sea. Was there an intention to have this album feeling and sounding more like a space rock album than the last one?
More ambient, you mean?
More full on rock. Actually, more full on space rock, because the feeling was, I thought, you know, as we were moving through the album, the instrumental tracks came like at the right time. You know, you're ready for something to sort of settle you down before you had the next surge of menace and energy.
Well, yeah, it's all about dynamic, I think, with Dave. You know, you don't get any light and dark if we're just pounding away all the time, you know. So it's and it makes the rockier bits more effective when you've got the ambient bits in between. Yeah.
And when you look at the concluding tracks in Frozen in Time there, and Stargazers, which, now you talked about jazz, and I thought that had quite a jazz feel to it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we do like going off at tangents like that, don't we? I mean, Magnus can actually play some really good jazz keyboards that he ought to do more often, I would say. Well, I mean, you know, the difference is, when we did the live show at the Albert Hall, when you did your acoustic number, wasn't it? I mean, the visuals on that are absolutely fantastic, because we've got these robots, undersea robots, in an underwater city. And it is quite spectacular when you've got a combination of things like that on a screen, when, you know, people go to see us perform sometimes.
Yeah, so that's the one track that we've played live so far off of that album, isn't it, that we put in last year.
I think my favourite track actually was Traveling Time and Space, because it had something for me that felt like a bit of a David Bowie vibe, a bit of Heroes.
Yeah, that's because of the feedback guitar, the duet, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Well, the funny thing was, I actually had bought this guitar. I always wanted to get one, wasn't it?
The sustained guitar.
Guitar, you know. What a world. Another door opens up when you've got a sustained guitar, so you can do these wonderful sustained duets.
Oh, that's brilliant. Now, the album cover is interesting. Now, this is always an event, your album artwork. People can't wait to see and comment. And I put a picture, I put some of the images, on some of the social media platforms, which draw lots and lots of comment. People loving it. And in particular, they liked the very Art Deco piece, which I think is the back of the album.
Stuart, the artist, is a very good artist, actually. Chris got in touch with him, didn't you? Go on.
He's in Holland. He's really good.
Yeah, very, very good artist.
I thought, the back cover's great, isn't it? It kind of reminded me a bit of Roadhawks.
You've got a copy of the booklet that goes with it, haven't you?
Yes, I did. It takes you back to the days, and that when you have those conversations about, do you remember when you used to go and buy an album? And you'd come home and you'd put the album on and you'd sit and you'd, for the duration of the album, you would devour everything that was on the covers.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Well, quite wonderful, because we can actually do what we used to do, can't we? Well, you can open it up and, wow, look, you know, there's plenty of things to see. It makes it interesting. People say, why? What does it mean, the clock at that time? This is the question that everybody wants an answer to.
Yes, I've been told it's a very cosmic reason why it's 10 past 10.
There is a reason. So, but I think everybody's got to ponder on that for at least a year.
What, before you tell anybody?
Yeah.
They think 2024 is 24 minutes past 8. They don't realise it's the year. Yeah. It's quite... That's quite a weird one.
So it's nice to have our fan base, because they are the kind of fans who like to have a proper album. They'll listen all the way through, all the gaps, all the way it all fits together is really important. And it is, you're supposed to sit down, look through the booklet, you know, skin up on the cover, you know, and enjoy the whole experience.
Have you ever considered then doing a spoken word tour. So where you
know it.
that was very quick and unequivocal. Would that not appeal to you, sitting on stage and going through stories and looking back over this career?
Stories and poems, you mean?
You nearly did that for your solo.
I nearly did it, yeah. Yeah, it was quite an undertaking because all of a sudden you suddenly say, yeah, that's a good idea. And then you suddenly realise you've got to have all good stories and some really good poems to read and retain people's interest for a long period of time and take questions from the audience that you don't want to give answers to and things like this.
Is there a question that you dread people asking you?
What's your favourite album?
Yeah, not really. I mean, we've had lots of questions over the years. And
it's such a career. 55 years ago this August that you debuted at the All Saints Hall as Group X. And you used to say that our aim is to freak people out without needing to take acid. Is that still the case?
I don't know, Mavis, what do you think? You're younger than me. I mean, we'll try and, yeah, I mean, take people on journeys with the music, don't we? Then, in that era, different eras, people take different drugs, and it was different 60s, 70s, totally different, really.
Well, yeah, most of them did take acid before they listened to it, didn't they?
Yeah. And now, I mean, you know, you think, well, yeah, we can take people on journeys with our music and our light show.
Well, it is with the lights and the projections and all the stories. Like it should be for the audience. It should feel like they've been through an experience without necessarily having to take the mind expanding drugs to go along with it.
And this was a story you talked about over time. The night that you did drop some acid at the Roundhouse 2 hours before going on. And delaying your arrival on stage, and when you took to the stage, you said it was amazing because all the audience turned into skeletons.
Yeah, it was a most not a very nice experience, I might add. It also happened that at the Roundhouse, they had nice salads there, actually, and I'd had this salad that had beetroot in it. And as I was eating the beetroot, I suddenly freaked out because I thought I was chewing my tongue. And I tongue, and it was real, and sort of things like that's not the sort of thing one wants to have happen. Yeah,
I think that Lenny was panicking, wasn't he?
I think we had quite a few panics on stage. Yeah,
it does sound amazing. So too, by the way, does reading books on Turner paintings at, what was it, the Who's ex-manager's place, and finding all the images, or interacting with each other.
Yeah, the funny thing is, all those images. Obviously, he painted these pictures. I mean, you can see them. I can see them still. I think in the old psychedelic artwork that people used to take acid to, you can see all these things once you've seen it once.
Didn't we use a Richard Dadd painting for Somnia?
Yeah, we did.
Richard Dadd used to have all of the
fairies.
The fairies and this mad things.
How well did you know Eric Clapton back in the day? Yeah, these were the times when you're busking, the early days. And you said, you know, we used to pop around to Eric's flat for a cup of tea. And this is when he was with Cream. So how did you come about to be friends with Eric Clapton and end up popping around for tea in the afternoon?
Well, because we used to hang out in Richmond in a cafe called the Low Burge Cafe. And I mean, around that time, Il Poi Island Jazz Club.
Before he was in Cream.
We were sort of 17 years old, quite young. Listening to lots of old blues musicians, like Brian Lemon Jefferson and Big Bill Brunsey and people like that. And we used to, that was it.
Didn't he break your guitar?
No, he got drunk on cider and fell over backwards and sat on his guitar. We were sitting in Richmond Park, actually. Or was it Strawberry Fields? There's a place at Twickenham called Strawberry Fields.
Didn't you teach him some chords?
I taught him a few chords to play, blues. Yeah. So that's how.
Can we just get that straight? You actually taught Eric Clapton some blues chords.
Yeah. I know. But I mean, I had known him quite a long period of time. So.
So you see, these are the type of stories that people would lap up, by the way. You're sat on stage just going to a general conversation. And there are so many of these moments, like people forgetting maybe or not even knowing around that period of Levitation, I think it was, back in the early 80s, Ginger Baker joined up for 18 months.
Yeah.
Courtesy of Hugh's wife, Marion, wasn't it, who worked in his... management office.
Yes, we had 2/3 of Cream in our band, didn't we? not together, but...
How did it pan out? I mean, because he did have a reputation for being difficult, or it was quite an interesting reputation. Yeah. So how did he get... Because he was there for 18 months.
Well, I've got on with him okay, actually. What he was... A world-class drummer, I mean, yes, and...
You got on all right with him.
Yeah, I got on with him fine, and...
We were all Leos, we all used to shout and
No problems at all, really.
and then forget about it. Yeah.
Who was it that ended up cracking him over the head with the pool cue?
That was me.
That was true.
he kicked my dog.
No.
He was trying to kick
unforgivable.
My dog, so I hit him with a pool cue. But then anybody would, wouldn't they?
Yeah. No, that's absolutely unforgivable. I did want to touch on something which is quite interesting. Now, we've seen a lot of elite sports people, right, who've become vegetarian and vegan and swear that it helps prolong their careers as elite athletes. So do you think that you're reaping the benefits now for your, you know, natural existence?
Well, I think so. Magnus is one as well, aren't you, Magnus? So,
you're vegan.
Yeah. But you're really healthy, aren't you, Dave? And you've been a...
Yes, you do.
I think if everybody... we'd have a lot healthier world if... everybody actually stopped eating meat and fatty foods and such.
Animals.
Yeah, basically.
And everybody in the hot place, didn't it? They all had problems. And they all ate meat.
The funny thing is now, I mean, when you look at television adverts, mainly they're all about either cremation, people being overweight, eating crap food, and
having heart attacks,
problematic things with the national health. It is quite an insurance, basically, isn't it?
Painful incremation.
Yeah. It's not so good. It's not so good watching television these days. And they last for 10 minutes as well, which pissed me off too.
So tell me, the expectations, do you have expectations when you release new albums? Do you sit there and you think, right, for this... to be considered a success, I mean, it has to get into the charts and do this, and we have to sell this many, or does it simply not matter? You're just fulfilling what your birthright is, basically, after the creed, which is just to continue producing music.
Yeah, we're artists. That's what we are, artists. Producing artists that we're creating music, sounds, instead of painting pictures with... brushes.
I think we're quite lucky, really, in the sense that we don't have any interference from the record company or anyone else, really. We just make exactly the records that we want to make. And then if people like them, that's great. And if they don't, we don't really care.
Have you found that there's a new Hawkwind fan these days? Maybe younger? Are you seeing any younger people at your gigs? Is there an audience that wasn't there once but is now there now? Has this evolved?
Over a period of years. I mean, it's the policy that we've always hoped for because, you know, years ago when we used to play under the flyover in Notting Hill Gate, it was all the poor end of Portobello Road, and just across the road, there was the reggae shop that used to sell all these fantastic old reggae records, and they had two huge great speaker cabinets outside blasting out reggae music. And everybody, age group there was from 80s to 3-year-olds, were all dancing around. And I used to think, wow, that's really the way to do it, isn't it? That's what music's about.
Yeah, and we get people, they bring their children and their grandchildren. Yeah. And yeah.
In recent years, there's a lot more women come to your gigs than say in the 80s. You know, all the sort of Levitation, Sonic Attack, the rock time, it was mainly young men, wasn't it? It was all sort of lads in the audience. Yeah. But now I would say it's a fair proportion.
Yes, it's less male-orientated audience now, I think, isn't it, over the last few years.
Yeah, which is a good thing.
So a new feature is simply called Golden Anniversary, and it's self-explanatory really, isn't it? It's when we're going to look back at some of the things that occurred 50 years ago this month. And so the month of March 74, it gave us many things. And for the rock music aficionados of the time, pocket money and salary, cash, and plenty of it, was going to be heading into the hands of your friendly local record store. And what were you buying? Well, you could have been buying Kansas' debut album this month. How was it received? Well, not particularly well, as far as the NME were concerned, because they weren't impressed at all. Listening to the album, a boring enterprise. Rolling Stone were much better, gave it just one star. It did sell 135,000 copies on release. And since then, obviously with the success that came after, of course, Left Overture, etc., a lot of people went back to rediscover, and it currently stands at past 500,000 copies. Queen 2 is also out this month. NME, well, they did like this one. It has every quality that makes them unique, they said. Sounds 2 loved it, captures them at their finest. Record Mirror, though, did not. Call it the dregs of glam rock. Weak and overproduced. The last words, well, why use one or two when nine will do? It was Robert Christgau in Cream magazine. And this is how he reviewed Queen 2. Wimpoid, Royaloid, Android, Heavyoid, Void. And I'll leave you to think up of a word with void in it that describes that review. Now, March the 18th, Rush's debut album hit. Billboard came out saying that this serves up a good dose of hard rock music. And they also highlighted the often Robert Plant-like sounding vocals. Went in the top 100, or just outside the top 100, 105 in the US, certified gold as well. And what was your favourite track on that? There is a track that they still play right up until the very end off of that debut album. It was, of course, the full glorious 7 minutes plus of Working Man. March the 15th saw Aerosmith return. Get Your Wings was released. It was described thus, a tough and nasty rock and roll vision. Robert Christgau was at it again. If you're going to be dumb, it might as well be American dumb. Here, Aerosmith, that is, they are loud and cunning enough to provide a real treat for the hearing impaired. It's outrageous, isn't it? Absolutely outrageous. Let's remind you that this album has gone on to sell 3 million copies, obviously. Contain the likes of Same Old Song of Dance, Lord of Thighs, Train Kept a Running, Seasons of Wither. So obviously the general public, the music-loving public, the rock music cognoscenti and the aficionados copped a deafen to the critic. Seasons of Wither, by the way, Steven Tyler, writing about it, said, "I used to be in my bed at dawn, listening to the wind in the bare trees and how lonely and melancholy it sounded. And I was pissed off about my taxes. And getting mad helps me to write. So I went to the basement, there was a rug on the floor, took a few things, lit some incense, and wrote Seasons of Wither." Joe Perry was not a lover of the ballad. He particularly didn't like, obviously, Dream On, which was played to death, still indeed is. But he did like Seasons of Wither. So there you go. And lastly, a mention here for The Hoople by Mott The Hoople. And remember that great album cover, the image of Carrie Ann Moder. She appeared on the front of Roxy Music's debut album as well. Roll Away the Stone, the biggest hit here. Listen to the track and you'll hear the backing vocals from the female trio called Thunder Thighs. They also did the backing vocals on Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. It's also got Marionette, another great track, live and studio version. I think Joe Elliott did a version of that as well recently. The Golden Age of Rock and Roll is also on there. And lastly, in moments of real history this month, the Ramones played their first gig in New York at the Performance Studio. That was in the last days of March of 1974. And that is it. We will have more from that golden period in the next show. So we move on to Bywater Call. Now, those of you who know, know. And those of you who don't, well, think about this as a gift. Hailing from Canada and fronted by the extraordinary vocal talent that is Megan Parnell, they managed to seamlessly blend everything from blues, rock, roots, Americana, a bit of folk, a bit of gospel, everything blended together. They've got a new album. It's coming out this summer. They are on tour virtually everywhere, including around Europe, so no excuse not to get out and see them. Now, I caught up with Megan at home in Canada last week to get a little bit of the story about where they came from and her musical evolution, if you like. And to take us there, how about this? This is Sweet Maria. I wanted to get a bit of backstory on you about the love of music and how it began. And you grew up, didn't you, in what was, it seemed to me, to be a pretty musical house. You sound like you had very cool laid-back parents. I mean, your mother with a guitar, singing Grace Slick and Joplin and Hendrix. So she must have had some voice.
I think so. I mean, I try to get her anytime we're in a bar together, there's a chance for her to get up on stage. I try, but she's like, I can't sing anymore. But yeah, I mean, it was her with an acoustic guitar was just always, she had this like 12 string that she put a bunch of money into, and it was the only guitar she ever had. And her whole family, like she was from a really big family, is from a big family. And a lot of them just kind of had picked up the guitar. She's one of the younger ones, so she got it from her older brothers and stuff. And yeah, after we moved on from lullabies and kids' tunes, she just started, playing me.
I mean, it's a great grounding, isn't it? Because you grow up listening to all of these amazing songs from incredible artists. I do love the fact that your talent was obviously seen very early on. Because there's your grandmother marching you into neighbors' houses and being told to perform. So, I mean, how did that work?
I mean, I have vague recollections of it, but I do remember being, brought over to the neighbors and probably helped with, stage fright. I mean, there wasn't a moment I wasn't singing or didn't want to sing. So, we go back old family videos and there's just like me forcing my siblings to like put on little concerts with when we would have a camera, when we'd have a camcorder at home or whatever. And yeah.
So literally you are born to perform.
I suppose so. I just don't remember a time when it wasn't like a part, even when I wasn't doing it professionally, when it wasn't a part of who I was,
You love to sing big show tunes as well, didn't you? I mean, I know there was a thing about Over the Rainbow, but wasn't your favorite one of the ones that was called Somewhere Out There from that Disney, the film American Tale with the mouse?
That's talking about, the videos on the camcorder. I was at my brother's a couple weeks ago and he was like, look what I found. And he had found like a USB stick with old family videos, and one was him and I doing a duet of Somewhere Out There from American Tale.
Brilliant. So what were you listening to then when you were growing up? I mean, we know what your mother was playing you.
Yeah.
But did they have big music collections? And were you sort of regularly raiding those and going, wow, what is this?
It was pretty eclectic, I think, in my house. Like, it was never like a focus on a particular genre, though my mom was like a massive Beatles fan. My dad had some B.B. King albums, Janis Joplin was a thing. For me, Bette Midler was a huge early influence. Canadian Katie Lang was played a lot, Bryan Adams, Bonnie Raitt. So those were some of the stuff that was some of the things that were played around for me a lot. And then I got really big into musical theater and Alanis Morissette, and then like just really kind of all over the place.
Yeah, you were drawn to the stage as well, weren't you? The grade six, wasn't it? Your first live performance, Tale of Two Lands.
I'd say that was my first live performance in a leading role, but I did previously play a mouse in a production of Lady and the Tramp.
Who the hell was Princess Golly Gotcha?
Good question. I've never heard of this musical before or since. It was clearly made for children's theater.
I was looking for it because I thought, there might be something in here with something blues related.
Yeah, no, it's a school,
I couldn't even find it.
Musical. I have no clue. I haven't tried to look it up, but I could sing some of it still, which is crazy.
So with all of these interests, obviously, in performing or everything, what was the call then for you to study human biology, which you did your degree in? Where did that come from?
I was a good student. I really liked high school, especially, and I really loved, you know, aside from loving music, I loved science and math, just loved it. And my dad was a chemical engineer. So, you know, I had that also, part of me was also just always to sing, but another part of me was always like, well, I'm going to go to university and get a degree. It was just kind of the natural way of things. Now I did audition, aside from applying for science programs at a few universities here, I did audition for an exchange program that had come up at the same time to go to a theater school in, I think it was Norway. And I was runner up. Wow. So if I had gotten that, I would have taken off and gone to theater school. But for some reason, that was the only, at the time, was the only kind of theater school or music school direction I had taken.
So were you planning on going to do medicine or anything?
Briefly. And I kind of realized I didn't want to spend all my time and money on school. And
yeah,
kind of after I graduated, wasn't really ready to go back and do more education.
You ended up working in film distribution, didn't you, with Cineplex for a while. Yeah. So were you into films and movies as well?
I mean, I like the theater as much as the next guy, but I was not a film buff. It was just something I kind of fell into and enjoyed. Like, it was in the arts, and I had a few really good bosses that kind of kept me inspired. And I learned a lot because I ended up moving from Cineplex to like a few small distribution companies where you kind of have to handle all aspects of of the industry. So that was really cool. And then I eventually did film PR for several years, which helps a bit being in music where I can kind of, I understand a bit of that world.
You did veer off for a while, didn't you? Because you ended up in a band for what, 4 or 5 months in Morocco. What was the story behind that? And what were you playing out there?
It was covers. It was a residency club gig, but it was my first real experience with professional singing, getting paid for it. I was tiring of my job at the time, and most of the satisfaction for singing that I was getting was karaoke stuff. And for some reason, in this moment, one of them I knew previously, but there were two guys putting bands together who needed singers. So I joined these two bands and I was playing cover music like once or twice a week. And then the one got a contract in Morocco. So I went from doing karaoke to once or twice a week to 6 nights a week in a smoky dungeon of a bar in Casablanca. we did 2 months in Casablanca and 2 months in a tourist city south of there called Agadir.
You basically spent 9 years in film PR. So during that time, did you think that, well, okay, I'm going to keep the day job going and I'll just sing for pleasure and you know, maybe in a few bands and whatever.
I mean, it seemed feasible to do both. Like I decreased the numbers of hours as like the current bands I was playing with at the time, as they got busier and doing it more regularly became a reality, I decreased the hours of my film job. And then it just got to a point where me and Dave, my partner, who was running the cover band that we were doing at the time, we had been talking about writing for a long time. And it was with him running that band, which at that point had gotten really busy, and me holding a day job, it just didn't seem like we were going to be able to find time to be creative, especially when you're first getting into it. But for me, kind of always, like it takes a while to get into a creative space and you need a bit of air, and we just didn't have that. So I was like, okay, we're going to do this. I'm going to quit my job. We're going to make time for it. I was making enough money singing. So it's like, okay, it's worth the pay cut. Let's give it a try.
What amazes me here that it's so obvious to anybody that isn't, well, deaf, that you possess a remarkable talent. And I find it hard to believe that during the time that you were working, after you met Dave and you put together the gigging, the corporate wedding and private function band, nobody ever was sat there and thought, oh my God, she's like unbelievable.
I mean...
I can't believe that nobody heard it.
You get the like, oh, you should go audition for Canadian Idol or, you know, any of those shows.
But you know what? I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Toward the end. Have you ever thought about doing that? You can almost see the reaction from whoever the judges are.
Well, I mean, I did. I went once or twice for the Canadian Idol thing. I think it was twice. And the second time I got through to like the first round of celebrity judges, which is non-televised or anything like that. But I mean, part of that, one, I wasn't gigging at the time. So I don't think I had maybe the stage presence or whatever the charisma they were looking for. I don't know. But also you need a really good story. Like it's a TV show, right? It's not strictly about talent, though they do get incredibly talented people on those shows. There's a lot of talented people out there. So it, you know, they're looking for other stuff. I guess I didn't have it or something. I don't know. Yeah.
God, well, that's their loss. Yeah. So when you've put the band together, the direction, what made you choose the direction that you went in? One of your quotes, we like to give balance. You have a rockier side, but we live in a groovy mid-tempo music. So what made you land there as opposed to any of the other genres?
When we seriously started talking about starting an original project, it was like no doubt kind of the influences we were going to draw from, which was the stuff that was really pulling us in at the time. We had discovered Tedeschi Trucks Band a couple years prior to that and had really been digging into a lot of their blues influences and have been listening. You know, Dave is very knowledgeable in like classic rock and, you know, so I don't know, drawing from a rock, but one of the things we got from say like Tedeschi Trucks or Sharon Jones or Amy Winehouse or Solomon Burke or Otis Redding is there's a warmth in that sound that I think is missed sometimes in like straight up rock music.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just was very important to us. I mean, emotion and music and making people feel something is for us kind of the most important. And that's, we were seeing that in those influences, and that's kind of where we wanted to go.
So your voice hasn't always had the characteristic that it has now, because you actually lost it at one point. And when it reappeared, as you've said it before, it was somewhat different. And you have this rasp and basically something that you didn't have before.
Yeah, there wasn't like the grit to it for sure. And I mean, that may have come naturally with the amount I was singing anyway, but I had like earlier as a singer, I had always identified myself as a soprano. I was always really proud of like these high notes that I could hit. And those were the roles I always took on. I often took on in musical theater, although I did love a good belting tune. You know, I always had the power in my voice. And then when I did this Morocco tour, I had, first of all, I'd never sung with that much frequency in smoke. Didn't really know how to take care of myself. And then it was all fine until I got sick. And then when I got sick, I was not given a chance to recover. You know, we still had to do this 6 nights a week. Yeah. And I was still singing like 45, 50, sometimes 60% of the lead vocals. And so I was just, you know, throwing injury on injury with my voice. And by the time I left, I could barely speak, which was really, really scary. But there was no damage. Wow. Everything was good. I just, had to learn to take better care of.
The band getting together in 27, and literally since the beginning, you've been on a mission. I mean, your work ethic is significant. I mean, you know, I look back through some of the tours and where you've been and, you know, how often you've been there. And there are times when you just getting on a plane, going to Europe, doing two dates, coming back, going to Canada, then getting on another plane, going to the US. It takes a lot out of you, doesn't it?
Yeah. Last year in particular was crazy. It was the first time we were doing, we had been doing Europe for a few years, but it was the first time we were doing Europe plus some stuff at home in Canada. Plus, we had started working with a U.S. booking agency, and they definitely filled our schedule, and we wanted to make as much of it happen as possible. I mean, getting in front of people is key.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and a lot of it was really cool, interesting stuff. So, yeah, we definitely, flew in and out for a festival in Germany.
96 shows, yeah, 10 countries, 89 cities, and that doesn't include the support slot that you did with Robert John and the and
yeah,
the Wreck.
Another 20-something.
I mean, that is seriously impressive. What was also equally impressive, again, if you go back and look at the comments, because I went back and looked at the comments and the people that were writing, you know, about the gigs, or they'd seen you, or they'd never seen you before. There wasn't one negative comment anywhere. I mean, it was all, oh my, you know, this is fantastic. She's unbelievable. They're simply the best thing I've seen all year. You know, you got to go and see them. And again, it takes something for you to be able to maintain that level of consistency over that period of time. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Well, I think for the band as a whole, it was a pretty good, I mean, by the time the end of the year came around, we were so locked in. Like that, which was great. I think it really reflected on how we got along on stage together and how we performed. And again, because I went through what I went through with losing my voice way back when, I do have techniques in place to kind of maintain, which, you know, running a schedule like that is important.
Yeah, vocal exercises.
Yeah, and I had, you know, very little incident last year where I was felt like I was struggling, which was very nice. Thank you for that.
So to follow on, yeah. This is a big year. We've seen the single releases. There's an album on the way. There is a lot of touring to come as well. How important a year is this for the band? And what would you consider to be a successful outcome for the end of the year?
I mean, our biggest goal is to just reach more people with what we're doing. So, you know, part of that is stepping up in terms of some of the venues and cities we play when we come back to the UK in the fall. We're playing a lot more major cities than we did last time, which is nice to see. And then, I mean, the elusive online following that is, I think, especially difficult for maybe a band that lives in our genre, although I don't know we're a cross-genre band, I think. But, you know, figuring
that out.
Does
that help you?
I don't know.
Because, I asked this question now. Oh, it was somebody called Jane Getter, who is an incredible guitar player from New York. And she came out, she said, well, I'm cross between Led Zeppelin, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, the this, the that, da, da, da. I said, but isn't the danger that you're trying to appeal to too many audiences and you're actually missing one?
We do, because, you know, we've kind of come up in the blues scene, which we love and appreciate and has done a lot for us. You know, we continue to do a lot of stuff in that genre. We worry sometimes that we're disappointing people who are looking for like a straight up 12 bar blues. It's just not what we do. But I do think, that our music does belong in some, you know, like there's a bit of folk, there's definitely tons of soul in there. And how do we reach kind of beyond the blues fans and find the other fans who I think would respond well to what we do, but just finding out how to get in front of them. I think that's more of the challenge than like, I don't think we're reaching far enough, or we don't know how to,
Because everybody you play it to, the more people that hear it, the more people that like it. I mean, it is really that simple, isn't it? If you look at those two albums, again, you go back and you look at the reviews, both of them drew plenty of acclaim from critics. 30, 40 years ago, that might have been enough, but now it isn't because, you know, social media exists. If you look at the amount of things vying for people's attention in music and entertainment, it's quite possible that with people's attention spans, which are usually seconds to minutes maximum, they simply miss you.
Yeah, it's a different world for music for sure. But I do feel like
How are you going to make sure that that doesn't happen?
We're still figuring it out. But you know, I think one of the things that we don't do a lot on social media right now, which I would like to do, I hope people would respond to it, is maybe being a bit more personal. You know, maybe logs from the road. We have our busted up, awesome bus when we're touring in North America and kind of giving people a bit of that perspective. Yeah, and then
that is a perfect. That's a perfect thing because the old what do you call it, old Buster? It broke down, busted. Didn't it?
Oh, God. Yeah, it was harrowing. It was.
But the other thing is, you were doing the driving.
Yeah,
you did work in PR for 9 years, so you know the importance of getting the message out and the continuity of it.
Yeah, I mean, TikTok and Instagram weren't really a thing when I was doing film PR, so it's, you know, we're figuring it out.
So when you get on tour this year on the road, are you going to have somebody designated to do the filming?
I mean, we're talking about it. John, our keyboard player, is the newest member of the band and the youngest. So we feel like that should be on his shoulders.
And going back to the album, when is the album due?
So it'll be this summer. We have a date in mind. We're just not quite ready to throw it out there, but
has the title been published yet?
The title will be Shepherd, which is right. a lyric from one of the tunes that's already out there. We'll have,
what's the relevance of the title?
So it's a lyric, it's a lyric from, it's from Colors. Yeah, it's a lyric from a tune we're going to be putting out, called Colors, which we absolutely love. And the lyric is a shepherd with none of her sheep, which we just thought was a really cool image. So we're kind of using that imagery. We're doing things differently this year. I think that reflects a bit of our situation too. Like we're doing self-producing and recording and mixing on this album. So I think it kind of reflects that experiment.
There's always been, well, in the album so far, I thought a healthy variation of the content. I mean, there's no two tracks really that appear the same. So you simply wouldn't get bored and you'd stay there going, well, I wonder what's coming next then. You know, we've got a bit of gospel, a bit of blues. So is this format going to follow?
I would say so, yes. Yeah, it's like we throw in a little bit of funk, kind of. We did that on the last album too. It's a nice collection of tunes. I'm feeling really good about it. You know, we've got a couple of the rockier ones like Holler.
It's brilliant. I mean, amazing. When I played it, I think I must have played it 3 or 4 times on the loop. You know, while I was sat there, and yeah, this is really great. Tell me, how did you find the reaction to you in the different countries that you have been in over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, it's all pretty positive. You start small for the most part. We were blown away. Our first proper tour ever, aside from, a handful of things we were doing at home, was touring Europe in January and February of 2020. And we did not know what to expect. We're like, nobody knows us out there. And it was small clubs, but the response and the attendance was kind of mind-blowing at the time. We were like, wow, like, who are these people who are kind of willing to take a chance on something they don't really know. So that was awesome. And then we did the UK for the first time last October. And that was, again, we weren't sure what to expect there. And the turnout and the response was awesome. You know, our worst attended was still not, you know, it was a half full room in London and, you know, the major city on a Monday. So like, I can't really complain about that. So overall, you know, we're seeing pockets in the States where we're really reaching people. So overall the response is good. It's just finding a way to spread the word.
Brilliant. And what about you? I mean, because not many people know too much about you. Not many people know too much about any of you, actually. So what do you do apart from music? What are your hobbies? What do you like to do on the day off?
Like, for better or for worse, this band takes up most of the time in our house. It's, you know, Dave and I run the band. It's most of what we talk about and most of what we work on. But, you know, we have a nice group of friends. So going out and, you know, when we can, checking out some of our friends playing around town. And I don't know. I should have more hobbies, but.
Are you a beer drinker? Do you like
I don't
beer,
mind or are beer. You a spirit? I like beer on a hot day. A cold beer is pretty awesome. I really like dry wine and a margarita, you know, a fancy anyway. Any fancy cocktail that's more sour than sweet. Oh yeah?
Yeah, you'll have to get down to Sammy Hagar's place down in Cabo Wabo Cantina.
There's one of those in Las Vegas.
So last thing. Mm-hmm. Which sort of puts you on the spot a bit.
Uh-oh, okay.
Are you too good to fail?
No.
Whenever you hear you for the first time, it almost demands that you stop and listen. But we see this so often with who you think they have got to be huge. What is wrong with the world? So are you confident that you will reach your ultimate objective?
I'm going to say yes, because I think without that confidence, you probably won't get there. So.
Well, that was the really quite fabulous Megan Parnell from Bywater Call. The new album, as she was saying, is going to be out this summer. And do go to their website and check out the tour dates and get on to see them. And go to YouTube as well. There's some great live footage of theirs on there too. And that's it. That brings us to a close for this edition. I'll be back in a few weeks' time. Once again, we will have a selection of special guests. So keep an eye out for the trailer, because some interesting people are going to be popping up on that show. And while you're here, don't forget to visit the website, www.theclassicrockpodcast.com, where you will find a lot of exclusive content that doesn't appear on the podcast, including video interviews and features, including, actually, if you want to check the video interview we did with Megan, that is going to be on there in the next couple of days as well. And to conclude the show then for today, the latest track from Bywater Call, it is called Holler. Thank you again for tuning in to listen wherever you are listening in the world. And don't forget, you can get in touch via the website or the Facebook pages. In the meantime, though, until next time, from me, Tim Capel, bye-bye for now. Two.